Welcome. My name is Hadassah Drukash. I'm your host, and this is the Law of Tech podcast. Digital technologies are disrupting and transforming the law and legal industry at an unprecedented speed and, in until recently, unimaginable ways. And this is just the beginning. The question is, how do we prepare the legal world of tomorrow? In this podcast, I interview experts across the industry and beyond and speak to leaders in law who are thinking outside the box and questioning the status quo. Together with them, I will delve deeper into some of the pressing questions, topics, and issues at the intersection of law and digital technologies that are shaping and reshaping the law as we know it and guiding the legal profession towards the future. Hi, and welcome to the very first episode of the Law of Tech podcast. For this episode, and as part of launching the Law of Tech, I have partnered up with CPDP for its 14th International Conference on Computers, Privacy, and Data Protection. In line with the topics, issues, trends, and ideas addressed and discussed during the CPDP conference, we will be delving deeper into a very fitting and timely topic: online price discrimination in the light of EU data protection law. And for the kickoff of the very first episode of the show, I'm accompanied by the very kind and knowledgeable Kimia Haidari. As of March 2020, Kimia joined the Department of Business Studies at Leiden Law School to commence her PhD research on online price discrimination. Before coming to Leiden University, she obtained her Bachelor in Law at Utrecht University, as well as a Master in Persuasive Communication Science at the University of Amsterdam, and a Master in Private Law with a specialization in Intellectual Property Law at Utrecht University. In her PhD project titled An Empirical Legal Examination of Online Price Discrimination, Justice and Regulation, Kimia addresses the practice of online price discrimination. The research aims to investigate how online price discrimination is perceived by consumers and regulatory actors and what its implications are for consumer behavior and market regulation. Kimia, thank you very much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for having me. Such a lovely introduction. Thank you.
Now, your PhD project revolves around a very timely topic and a topic that is currently increasingly catching the attention of a variety of stakeholders in society. What led you to dedicate your PhD project to this topic, and how is the project going so far?
Well, so far so good, I think. I think what led me to the project is the fact that I have always been interested in the area between law and technology. And I think that has to do with the fact that I have a dual background in law and communication science, like you said. I've always been very interested in how those two interact and how we can use law to maybe mitigate some of the concerns we have about new technologies. So it's definitely personal interests combined with my educational background.
Yeah, I can really imagine that this topic and the wider implications of the practice you are studying really caught your attention, and I'm very excited to dig a little deeper into it, starting by taking a look into the past leading us to the present. Because really, the concept of price discrimination itself, including online price discrimination, is not new at all. To really kick off today's show, can you give us a brief insight into the development of price discrimination leading up to the online version thereof that we are seeing more and more today?
Of course. So yeah, like you said, price discrimination is definitely not new. It's one of the oldest pricing strategies there is, and the main underlying thought has always been that we as consumers are different from each other. We differ in our preferences, we differ in our price sensitivity, and how we value products and services. And that's what economists identified even back in the day. And based on that knowledge, they then approach the consumer accordingly. They can do so either directly or indirectly. And with direct price discrimination, the setter identifies the consumers and segments them accordingly. And with indirect price discrimination, the seller knows that there are different consumers, but he doesn't know precisely who belongs to which group. And what they then do is present all consumers with a variety of options and then let the consumers select for themselves. I think to answer your question, it's best to set a scene when it comes to offline price discrimination, and then I'll get into the developments that are happening online that are pushing price discrimination to new heights. And I think the best way to illustrate how it happens offline is by using the example of a market stall owner. So imagine you're walking up to his market stall looking to buy one of his products, and as you walk up, he sizes you up. He looks for visual cues that might give away how rich you are and how much you would be willing to pay. And he also taps into his previous experiences. Are you a first-time customer, or has he seen you there before? And if so, does he still remember things about you? Or has he seen clients that behave similarly to you? And this all happens in the mind of the market stall owner as you approach him. And then he can also base his judgment based on what you decide to disclose. So do you express how interested you are, or how you have been looking for this product for years? All those factors decide how the market stall owner sees you and treats you accordingly. However, a lot of that offline is in your own hands. For instance, you decide what you disclose and how you dress when visiting his market stall. Price discrimination could also be more indirect, where the seller presents consumers with a set of options and then lets them select for themselves. A great example are books. Publishers usually put out a hardcover of a book at first, and then after a while they put out the much cheaper paperback. This induces the impatient readers, who have the means to do so, to buy the hardcover at the usually much higher price. And the more patient readers, who might not be as interested or just aren't willing to pay top dollar, will wait until the paperback comes out. So in that case, the consumers voluntarily segment themselves based on their interest and price sensitivity. And then, to get back to the transition to online, there are a couple of developments that create a very interesting online environment in which online price discrimination can, in theory, reach new heights. And the main development is that of the big data capabilities of companies. Companies are now increasingly able to collect consumer information, as well as to analyze said data and act accordingly, often with the help of sophisticated algorithms. And as those big data capabilities increase, so does their potential to engage in more complex and personalized methods of price discrimination.
So really, the distinguishing factor between traditional price discrimination and online price discrimination is really that ability to make use of big data in determining what price to charge different customers.
Exactly. That's the main driver in how online price discrimination works. If we take the example of the market stall owner, for example, he had to go off of visual cues, where an online company has way more data to base its judgment on.
Now, as is clear from the insight you've given us, the developments that have taken place within the context of price discrimination, in particular leading up to online price discrimination, have turned it into a practice that is quite hard to fully comprehend without a clear definition and knowledge of its working. Now, you've given us a brief insight into the developments that have taken place within the context of this practice, but for those who aren't that familiar with the concepts of price discrimination and online price discrimination, how can these best be defined and how does this practice work?
I think the best way to define it is first to look at the classic definition for offline price discrimination, and that is the practice of charging a different price to different consumers for the same products, based on information a company has about the consumers. And in that case, it's important to note that the price difference shouldn't be due to cost. So for instance, if a company charges one consumer a higher price for the same product because that consumer happens to be living further away, there are therefore higher shipping costs for the company, then we don't see that as price discrimination. The prices are still different between consumers, but that can be explained by a difference in costs. So that is an instance where it isn't price discrimination. And how it then works online is very comparable to the offline scenarios that I mentioned. So companies can either directly price discriminate by identifying consumer segments and charging them accordingly, or they can use more indirect strategies where they let consumers select for themselves. However, for the direct price discrimination, so on the basis of consumer characteristics, there's this trend happening that is attracting quite some research attention, and that is personalized pricing. And that is basically online price discrimination shifting towards more fine-grained segments, or even according to some, shifting towards one-on-one pricing. And this is again due to the fact that companies' big data capabilities have increased and that they have access to algorithms that aid in segmenting customers and setting the prices.
Now, zooming in a little more into that term personalized pricing, while conducting some research on the topic, I also came across some experts that use the term to refer to a more specific form of online price discrimination, while other experts make use of that term to refer to a synonym for online price discrimination. Now, if I'm correct, you use the term to specifically refer to a more refined form of online price discrimination when you make use of that term personalized pricing.
Exactly. I've seen that too in papers where they use it as synonyms for each other. But I do think that personalized pricing is one of the forms in which online price discrimination can present itself. And it's indeed a more advanced form which uses more individual pieces of information.
Now, obviously, definitions are very, very important, especially when looking at the law and some of the legal issues and legal questions raised as a result of the practice of online price discrimination. But before we really delve into that topic, there is also much discussion on whether online price discrimination is good or bad, favorable or not, from an economic point of view. Researchers pointed out that opinions of non-economic scholars and consumers differ from those of economists on the question of whether online price discrimination is desirable. Now, without delving too deep into the economic aspects of online price discrimination, should it be considered a desirable practice from a welfare economic perspective?
Yeah, economic scholars definitely differ from non-economic scholars, especially the legal scholars. One of the most important things to remember is that from an economic perspective, price discrimination represents a very neutral concept. Like we discussed earlier, it's mainly about acting on the fact that in a lot of cases, consumers differ in their preferences and willingness to pay. So it's about differentiating between consumers for economic reasons, rather than a more normative or negative connotation that the word discrimination might suggest. Within the economic literature, there has been a lot of research on the outcomes of the welfare effects of price discriminations, and they have researched it in a lot of various different settings and with a variety of factors. And the results are very mixed, so there isn't a clear black and white answer as to when we find online price discrimination desirable. But generally, for price discrimination to be welfare enhancing, it should lead to substantial increase in total output by serving consumers that were otherwise unserved. And I think the best way to illustrate this is through a practical example, so we don't have to get into the economics of it too much. And that's the example of student discounts. I'm sure you know that as a student, you often pay reduced fees, for instance, at the movie theater. I've made use of that many times. And because you identify yourself as a student, you end up paying less for a movie ticket than a non-student. And the main thought behind this is that students generally have lower disposable income and are more likely to be price sensitive. And if the movie theater owner would charge a fixed price for all consumers, those students would probably not buy the tickets. But by playing into this knowledge and offering them a student discount, the movie theater owner can fill more seats. So put very generally, this leads to more profit for the movie theater owner, and the student in this case is able to see a movie they might otherwise not have been able to see.
So this really comes to show that there is still a lot of debate and really a lack of consensus on whether price discrimination in general and online price discrimination in particular should be considered favorable, really depending on the field you come from. Now, whether desirable or not, while new data analysis technologies, often summarized as big data, give new possibilities for tailored pricing, and according to a White House report, many companies already use big data for targeted marketing and some are experimenting with personalized pricing, examples of personalized pricing nevertheless remain fairly limited. One reason for the very limited practical examples of online price discrimination may be that companies are hesitant to personalize prices because they fear consumer backlash, as many people find price discrimination unfair or manipulative. And researchers pointed out that the main constraint on price discrimination comes from society's dislike of the practice. Why do consumers so strongly oppose this practice? I can imagine, and you already confirmed, that there really are also benefits to it.
Very good question. I think a lot of it has to do with how we think as consumers. So a lot of it touches upon consumer psychology. But as we have seen in the past, instances of price discrimination were often met with a lot of consumer backlash. I remember reading about the Amazon example that happened in 2000, I believe, where customers basically found out that if they would delete their cookies before entering the Amazon website, they would see lower prices than when they wouldn't delete the cookies. And this implied that customers who had previously ordered from Amazon and were existing clients would pay more than new customers. People were immediately angry and threatened to boycott Amazon because they felt duped and they thought it was really unfair. Amazon was very quick with releasing a press release, and they stated that they were randomly experimenting with prices rather than basing them on customer characteristics. And regardless of whether that is indeed true, the mere thought of Amazon engaging in pricing based on customer information was enough to cause a lot of backlash. I think to answer your question, it's best to set a scene, and I'm curious to see what your reaction is. So let's imagine you're planning a vacation abroad and you're browsing for a flight ticket. And this probably requires a lot of your imagination right now, but let's try. But let's say you booked a month in advance and you had to pay 2,000 euros for a ticket. Kind of expensive, but you really want to go on that vacation, so you pay the price. And a month later, you board the plane, and as you sit down, you hear the person behind you talking about how they also booked a month in advance. And then you overhear him saying that he only paid 500 euros. So what would then be the first thing that comes to your mind?
So in line with what we already just discussed, then perhaps as a natural reaction, I would be very surprised, especially considering the fact that both he and I bought the tickets under the same circumstances. So perhaps naturally, I think it would be very, very unfair. I'm not sure if that's a natural reaction or a normal reaction, but at least that is what would come naturally to me.
Yeah, that's a very logical reaction. I was hoping you would say that. Although the example is, of course, very exaggerated, that's what consumers tend to think. They find such practices unfair or even unethical. And there has been some research on what forms of price discrimination consumers find unfair, but the why question hasn't been examined in depth, at least not empirically. But there are some explanations that might explain why we find it unfair. And one of them is the feeling of missing out. As humans, we tend to avoid situations that could lead to loss or regrets. So finding out that you paid way more than the person behind you might trigger this feeling where you react negatively and feel like it's very unfair towards you. And you probably start wondering what you did wrong to get such a high price. Another explanation could be the feeling of being captive, of having no real choice. That explains why, for instance, consumers tend to find the idea of a supermarket loyalty card fair, because everyone can in principle have access to such a card and the discounts that come with that. So there's a clear opt-in, and previous research has shown that as consumers, we usually find such forms of price discrimination to be more fair.
Yeah, I get that. So the opt-in really prevents you from being put in a place where you feel like you really don't have a choice.
Yeah, exactly. Where you know that, let's say you're at the supermarket and you see that someone with a loyalty card gets a 20% off and you don't have a loyalty card and therefore you have to pay the full price. Of course, you can still find it unfair. But you quickly notice that if you were to get the loyalty card as well, you could get the same discount. So because of the opt-in, it doesn't feel like you're duped. You know what's happening, and you know that if you opt in for the same loyalty program, you can get the same deal. And I think the third and final explanation, which is also probably the most important for this podcast, is that of transparency. A student discount, for example, is very transparent. You know that students get a fixed discount on a product. And you also know if you, on the basis of your characteristic, belong to that group or not. But in the Amazon case, for example, consumers found out by accident. So if it's indeed true that Amazon based its pricing on consumer characteristics, where they differentiated new customers from existing ones, this could explain the negative attitude of consumers, because they would feel like it was done behind their back. And especially if it then results in some consumers having a worse deal, this can definitely trigger that sense of unfairness. But transparency seems to be a very big factor that affects people's attitude towards price discrimination.
Now, beyond opposition from consumers, it also remains unclear what forms of price discrimination they would, in fact, accept. given the fact that online price discrimination is shown to raise concerns from the perspective of social welfare and its distribution, and is met with much opposition by society, a valid question is if existing law can help. And this is obviously also a question you turn to in your research. One field of law that can be turned to for further assistance, and we'll be delving deeper into this, is privacy and data protection law. And for the purposes of this podcast episode, we'll be focusing exclusively on EU data protection law. Now, from a general understanding of EU data protection law, and more specifically the General Data Protection Regulation, or the GDPR, for this body of law to apply, there ought to be a practice of processing of personal data. Looking at online price discrimination, what sorts of data are being used for that purpose, and how is that data obtained?
As for the sorts of data, there are a lot of types of data that can be collected for the purpose of online price discrimination. I can name some examples to give you a sense of the scope. There are a lot of types of data that can be collected for the purpose of online price discrimination. In that sense, it's very comparable to other personalization practices, such as targeted advertising. Examples of data include, for instance, contact information, so your address, email, phone number, social demographic data, so your age, ethnicity, gender. It could also be transactional data, so your purchase history, for example. It could be more behavioral data, so your browsing history, your clicking behavior, how long you look at certain pages. It could be technical data about your device or browser, for instance. Or it could be also location data, where you're at the moment. So there are a lot of different types. These are not even, I don't even think they cover the ground of how much different data types there are out there. And I think as we progress, and a lot of our devices are connected to the internet, I'm sure you know, there will be even more types of data that companies can collect. As for the methods, companies use a wide range of technologies and methods to collect these data. Without getting too much into the technicalities, you could think of cookies, super cookies, device fingerprinting. And for online price discrimination, we can make a distinction between three methods of data collection. First of all, the data can be volunteered or surrendered by consumers themselves. For instance, when they create an account and provide personal information, or when they post on social media. Data can also be observed or obtained, often without the knowledge of the consumer. For instance, a company can observe a consumer's purchase history, browsing activity, or device characteristics. And that data can be obtained either directly from the customer or from third parties, such as affiliated advertising companies or data brokers. And lastly, the data can be inferred. And in this situation, companies take the volunteered or observed data and analyze them in order to make inferences about characteristics such as gender, age, or income. And then once all that data is collected, it's also about what companies then do with that data. So based on all that data, companies can make profiles, either at an individual level or at a group level. And these profiles contain assumptions about the preferences, abilities, or needs of that individual or the group. So basically what companies do, with the help of algorithms, of course, they look for patterns and connections in large data sets, which then can be used to make assumptions about consumers and to even predict consumer behavior. And in turn, those sophisticated algorithms can help companies in creating even more refined profiles. And by the way, you probably thought of that as well, those profiles and underlying assumption can very well be wrong.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely not under the illusion that algorithms also used within the context of online price discrimination are 100% foolproof and therefore make no mistakes at all. And I think it's actually a well-known fact that algorithms can and they do make mistakes with potentially grave consequences, especially when they make inferences or assumptions on the basis of a particular type of data or on the basis of a combination of different types of data.
Exactly. And I think an example of that is, let's say, an online store has an algorithm that segments people based on their browsing and purchase behavior, for example. And then let's say the goal of the algorithm would be to identify who of the customers is pregnant at the time. And they do so in order to present those customers then with personalized offers on baby products. And let's say one of my friends is pregnant and due soon, and I'm looking for a present I can get her. And as I browse the site's baby products and then purchase some of those products, the tracking software will collect that information, and the algorithm will probably assume that I belong to the group of customers that are expecting. So it's not 100% foolproof, but it does help a website identify the majority of customers that do belong to that group, so it can still be considered effective. But I think in the case of more sensitive data or sensitive assumptions, it's of course a big risk if there's a false positive, if you're assumed to belong to a certain group.
Now, looking more closely at the scope of application of the GDPR, the regulation states that it applies to the processing of personal data wholly or partly by automated means, and to the processing other than by automated means of personal data. For the GDPR to apply, two conditions thus ought to be fulfilled. There must be personal data, and there must be an activity of processing of that personal data. Given the nature of the data obtained for online price discrimination and the way in which that data is obtained and handled, does the practice of online price discrimination fall within the scope of the GDPR?
Good question. I think to answer your question up front, EU data protection law usually does apply to personalized pricing. As you said, one of the main conditions is that personal data is processed. And in the case when consumers voluntarily register for the website and create an account, the website can recognize them based on that login information. So therefore, in those cases, we usually assume that the practice does indeed fall within the scope of EU data law. I think the situation that might be more tricky is the case where consumers do not voluntarily provide information, but when such data is observed or inferred by the company. But that usually falls under the scope of the GDPR as well, because under a broad interpretation of the concept of personal data, even without traditionally personally identifying information, such as the name of the consumer, cookies with unique identifiers should also be seen as personal data. So such cookies are often used to track consumers and can be often traced back to an individual. So it's important to note that tracing a cookie back to an individual doesn't mean that you have to know the real name or identity of a customer. It's about being able to single out a data subject. So even in a case where consumers don't voluntarily identify themselves and the company either observe or infer data about the customer, as long as they are able to single out the consumer from a list of consumers, it still involves personal data and it still involves the processing of personal data. So yes, the practice falls within the scope of EU data protection law, because most personalized pricing involves the processing of personal data.
Now, assuming that EU data protection law, and in particular the GDPR, does indeed apply to online price discrimination, what are some of the legal issues this body of law raises within this context, and does the way in which the relevant data is obtained play a role?
Well, one of the main concerns that is raised with regard to data protection law is that of transparency, as we discussed. And as increasingly more data is involved in setting the prices and the methods are becoming more complex, it may not be transparent or expected by the consumer in the same way as when it occurs offline. So definitely the way in which the data is obtained plays a big part. But that is also part of a bigger discussion that we as consumers tend to be a bit short-sighted when it comes to our personal data. We do react quite strongly when an instance of personalized pricing comes to the light, but we also remain quite ignorant of the effect that the collection of our information might have on the prices that are then offered. So we tend to be a bit short-sighted about the value of our data and how much we actually give away online. And that information then often forms the core of personalized pricing and is of great value to companies for whom such data can give quite a competitive advantage. But it's of course not all the consumer's fault, because under the GDPR, companies should inform customers or data subjects if they process personal data with the purpose of personalizing prices. And this should be done in a concise, transparent, and easily accessible form. However, there are no online shops that do so yet. Companies do disclose quite general sentences, such as, We use personal data to offer our consumers better personalized services. I'm sure you've seen that one.
Yes, I've definitely come across and heard of such vague purpose disclosures, and I take it that they really don't comply with the obligations under, for example, the GDPR, right?
Well, if they actually engage in personalized pricing, then not. That would not comply with current data protection law, because it's definitely not specified and explicit enough. But it also depends on whether companies are actually engaging in such practices. Maybe they aren't, and maybe it isn't as widespread as we think, and maybe due to the fear of consumer backlash, they either aren't engaging in it, or they're afraid to enclose it or disclose it in their privacy statements. Also, the technologies increasingly involved in online price discrimination are often very complex. Companies make use of algorithmic pricing, and while that could aid them in more effective and objective decision making, online price discrimination on the basis of algorithm decision making could lead to direct or indirect discrimination. Algorithms are inevitably value laden, as we call it, meaning that an algorithm reflects the values of the designer of the algorithm. Even without any bad intentions on behalf of the companies or designer of the algorithm, discrimination based on maybe legally protected characteristics such as gender, sexuality, or ethnicity can still occur as a result of machine learning. So such algorithmic decisions have the potential to discriminate against vulnerable classes in society. And under the GDPR, decisions on the basis of automated profiling require even more transparency. Companies have to explain that it uses such profiling and provide meaningful information about the logic of the profiling process. However, with those modern algorithmic techniques, such as machine learning, it's often difficult to assess on what factors the algorithm made its decision. So this poses a challenge for the companies to explain the logic behind the decision, but also for regulators and enforcement authorities to effectively keep an eye on the technology. So the question of how to effectuate or implement algorithmic transparency is therefore also quite a big point of focus.
So more focus on and the actual implementation of that principle of transparency may actually give us the means necessary to mitigate the potential negative effects and negative consequences that this leads to.
Well, if the main reason for people to dislike price discrimination is indeed the fact that it often happens secretly, then mandated transparency does indeed seem like a very logical regulatory answer. It could help with balancing the information asymmetry that currently exists between consumers and companies, because online companies tend to often know more than we are aware of or wanted to disclose in the first place. So added transparency as to how our personal data is processed, and in the case of automated decisions, how that decision came to be, could help mitigate that information asymmetry. And this could empower consumers, so perhaps they then choose to switch to another seller, for example. However, I have to add a quite critical note. This is under the assumption that consumers will, of course, read all the information, which they do not always do, I can tell from experience, and that there are alternatives for the consumers to even switch to. And the latter has to do more with market power and switching costs, and that is more in the area of competition law. So I leave that be, but it's added transparency is not always the key, since it also depends on how active consumers are in chasing that information.
Now, this is a very good point, and obviously there are many more issues that can be raised and addressed within the context of online price discrimination. And this practice does not merely trigger EU data protection law, but many other fields of law could be triggered by it too. You already mentioned competition law and anti-discrimination law, and also consumer protection law could be triggered by it. Perhaps also something we could discuss in a future episode. But for now, wrapping up this episode, looking towards the future, what are your predictions concerning online price discrimination? Will it become the new normal in 20 to 30 years from now?
That's a very good question. As part of my research, I've conducted quite some interviews with experts on the subject of data science, pricing strategy and marketing, and that resulted in a lot of interesting conversations. And drawing from what I heard there in my own opinion, I think that the trend towards personalization is definitely here to stay. Not only are companies inherently curious about their clients, we as consumers also expect personalization to a certain degree. And from a competitive perspective for companies, of course, it's all about staying relevant and tying consumers to your company or to your brands. And companies that have the means to collect a lot of data and analyze it accordingly will probably then have a big advantage, as knowledge usually equals power in this sense, given that the outcome is indeed relevant for consumers. But I also think that companies are well aware of possible consumer backlash that they can experience when engaging in more secretive forms of online price discrimination. And combined with the fact that making the right inferences is a challenge in itself, I think that companies are more likely to use their insight to fine-tune their segments rather than to perfect one-on-one pricing. So therefore, they will probably experiment more with pricing programs where customers can opt in and receive discounts rather than secretly charging some consumers at a higher price. I do have to say that as consumers or as humans in general, we adapt very quickly. I remember back in the days when flight tickets started fluctuating in price, people were very upset and they found it very unfair too. And now practically everyone is used to it, and we even exchange methods on how to get the best deal, such as deleting your cookies or using incognito modes.
So for companies, it's likely to be a very gradual development.
Yeah, so it will definitely be a very gradual development, and companies will adjust their strategies bit by bit as they simultaneously navigate how to keep their customers satisfied.
Now, assuming that this is indeed the case and that your predictions become a reality, to what extent do you consider data protection law to be the most suitable and desirable means to address this practice and mitigate its potential adverse effects?
I think data protection law is definitely a good place to start. Like you said, within legal regulation, there are more fields of law that have raised areas of concern and could simultaneously play a big role in mitigating the adverse effects that online price discrimination might have, such as non-discrimination law, competition law, and consumer protection law. But in any case, I do believe that the solution can't be found in only one of these fields of law, but it will most likely have to be a combined effort in order to cover as much as the complex ground that makes up this practice. However, as we saw, and like I said, it is a very complex practice, and the technology behind it is moving at a very fast pace. So perhaps it's not only a matter of legal regulation, but combining it with market and technology regulation as well. Either way, we really need to deepen our understanding of the practice and the perceptions of the parties involved before we move on to legal regulation.
So if I understand you correctly, you really stand behind a more comprehensive and all-encompassing approach to address online price discrimination, not only including data protection law, but also other fields of law. But even before actually looking at the law to address this practice, we should really gain a deeper understanding of the practice itself and involve the other parties, because as you also said, and as is known as a general fact, technology is always faster than the law, and therefore the law isn't always the most suitable means to address a specific practice and to mitigate its potentially negative effects.
Exactly, and I think there's a big role for empirical research in that sense as well in the future, because essentially law is based on assumptions we have about all the parties involved and how the market works and how we wish to then regulate that market. And I think in order to even get to the question of how or if we even want to regulate that market, you first need to have evidence-based insights into what is happening within the market and what is driving the parties and what do the parties think of online price discrimination. So there's a lot of research that has to be done still.
That's a really interesting perspective. And looking at the current developments in online price discrimination in the light of EU data protection law and your findings and predictions, I think we can safely conclude that the last word has not yet been said. For now, Kimia, thank you very much for joining me on the show. It was a pleasure to talk to you and hear more from you about this fascinating topic, and I wish you the best of luck with the furtherance of your PhD project.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to the Law of Tech podcast. If you want to make sure you keep up to date with the show and never miss out on an episode, be sure to subscribe on your podcast platform of choice, follow the Law of Tech on social media, and receive the Law of Tech's monthly newsletter by subscribing to it through the website www.thelawoftech.com. If you enjoyed the show, please give it a rating or review as it helps others discover the show. And don't forget to share it with your network. You can also support the show by donating to my Patreon, which helps support the running and production of the show. For now, have a great day, and I'll see you in the next episode of the Law of Tech podcast. Yeah.